Welcome to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders who impact our community. Now, the recipient of three First Place Virginia Association of Broadcasters Awards and the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
This morning, we're going to talk about some Civil War things. John Hennessy, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park, is back here with us. John, good morning. Good to have you here.
Morning, Ted. It's always good to be with the local radio legend.
And we are joined this morning by phone from Appomattox, Ernie Price, the chief of education and visitor services with Appomattox Courthouse National Historical Park. Ernie, good to have you on the program this morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
What is it like for you, because for the last few years, you have sat by and watched events take place all around the country, all around Virginia, and you knew that it was coming to you, and you were going to be it. You were going to be the last stop of the sesquicentennial observances.
Well, what it's like right now is a giant exhale, honestly, but no, you're right. I think it was really fortunate that we were last, and the Park Service did a smart thing. Starting back at First Manassas, they sent me to that event. I remember seeing John there, in fact, Antietam, Gettysburg, and all kinds of events throughout, as you say, and I took my notebook every time I went. And so by the time we got to 2015, we had learned a lot of best practices. We hopefully benefited from all of that, and I think we did.
Just the preparation, watching what others did, watching and seeing what worked and what didn't, probably, like you say, it probably helped you along the way as you watched it over the years.
Oh, definitely. I can remember specific moments, light bulbs going off in my head when I would see something at Manassas or Antietam, thinking, yeah, that's going to apply to Appomattox, and we need to really think about trying to do that. Just as an example, I remember standing at Antietam and our colleague Keith Snyder looking out to South Mountain, and he said, you know, all of these microwave trucks and satellite trucks and tents and food vendors and booksellers, all of this is behind us, but the view here in front of us doesn't change, no matter how big this event gets. And when people come for the 150th, they should be able to see this view just like they would any other day. And that really hit me in the heart. I thought, you know, we have such a view at Appomattox, and we don't want that view to be impaired even during the large event that is the 150th. And there were lessons like that all the time that by the time we got to 2015, I think we were in a good position to put on an excellent commemoration.
In contrast, John, you dealt with 3 years and a lot of days of battles over the last 3 years when you dealt with the sesquicentennial. Ernie and Appomattox had it for a few days.
Well, you know, lest people think that all that Ernie and the folks at Appomattox did was mimic what others did, they'd be wrong about that. Appomattox is a very, very special place. If you haven't been there, you ought to go there. Every American should go there. But it's a very special place, and that it's just, excuse me, it's just such a kind of pristine, powerful setting. Where your mind's eye can do work unlike almost any place else. And the park has a tremendous, deep tradition of living history on its grounds. And all of that combined to really to create a tableau almost, unlike anything that any of the other parks could create. And people really very strongly responded to that. You know, we didn't have a single day in our 26 days of sesquicentennial stuff in our park here that approached, in terms of numbers, the biggest days at Appomattox. And but you know what? It was just kind of awesome to watch. It went almost flawlessly logistically, and people don't realize when they come to something like that, all that goes into making it possible for them to be there. And to be there in a way that it goes smoothly and it's easy, and tremendous logistical challenges in Appomattox. And, you know, there's almost more people going through the park in 4 days than live in the county, for goodness sakes, by a wide margin. And so having the infrastructure and the ability to host all those people was a tremendous challenge. But you know what? I don't think I don't think I heard in the days that I was there a single unhappy voice. I think I heard more compliments about the park staff, the effort there, the visual spectacle, the intellectual adventure it was for people. It was just a tremendous capstone to the 150th. And those of us, there were five people from our park who were there, and I know that all of us were very proud to be part of it.
I know, Ernie, around here, the one thing I was able to participate in, unfortunately, I couldn't, wasn't able to come down there and would have loved to, but on Thursday afternoon at a little after 3, when they rang the bells in Fredericksburg, and I was downtown for that, and I got goosebumps and chills just thinking about it, and I can't imagine what it must have been like right there at Appomattox when you did the same thing a little bit earlier.
Well, we were very fortunate that our colleagues over at Cedar Creek actually came up with the idea. Amy Bracewell did, and we loved it for lots of reasons. But we've always felt that all of these national parks are unique. Every one of them has a great story that's unique to itself. One of the things about Appomattox that's unique is that it's a culminating site. And that's why I loved seeing my colleagues from Fredericksburg and Gettysburg and so many other places come in and be a part of this big, you know, finale at Appomattox, because, like the soldiers themselves, our stories are all over the country. They're all over the Mid-Atlantic and the South. And so the Bells Across the Land program was the perfect way. Amy had a brilliant idea that the bell at just after 3 o'clock, when Lee and Grant depart from the McLean House, would ring, signifying that the meeting was over and that the war was coming to a close. And we didn't assign any value to it beyond that. It wasn't a celebration bell. It wasn't a bell to mourn those that were lost or to celebrate the preservation of the Union or the emancipation of the slaves. It could mean any and all of those things, depending on who rang the bell and who heard it. But it gave us a great opportunity to connect Appomattox to all of those many other battlefields and towns and communities that were so turned upside down by the war. And it just seemed appropriate that Appomattox should be able to reach out, and those places should be able to connect to Appomattox at that key moment. That night, I was at home sifting through some Facebook, and somebody had posted the video of the bells ringing in Fredericksburg, and I got the same goosebumps 6 hours after it happened, just watching it at my home. It was a great idea, and it came off really well.
We assembled all the media coverage and all the social media activity on Bells Across the Land, and just counting the people who engaged the story through social media, there were more than 500 sites across the country who did it that did it on that day at 3:15. Of course, we started it at Appomattox, and I was involved in that program, and I have to say that I had a hard time getting through that program. And then the bell started ringing across the land, and my phone just lit up with text messages and videos and stuff coming from people across the country. We had school children in Alaska go out and ring bells at 11:15 their time that morning. And it was really just kind of a fabulous thing. There's something about knowing that people across the country are thinking about the same thing that you're thinking about at a given moment in time. There's a solidarity there that I think was very powerful for people, certainly was for me. And just like Ernie, I went back that night and kind of flipped through all the social media coverage of the event. And we still are finding communities and sites that participated in Bells Across the Land. And we were very glad that Fredericksburg did it. And but we're also glad that in Sitka, Alaska, they did it, and 500 places in between.
We don't. I find interesting in talking with you two is just how these kind of events, how you can be moved by them. That it's not so many people look at history as just timelines and words on a page or reading quotes, but when you are at these places or you're experiencing them or just. You're able to make it real, and these events that happened 150 years ago still can have an impact on each of our lives today.
That's definitely the power. I mean, I think people appreciate the documentation of historical events, and the Civil War is such a dramatic thing that we some of us can't get enough of that. But I think the real power is, and the reason that it's so intoxicating is because somewhere inside of us, we still see it playing out in our lives today. It is so relevant. And we certainly don't want to get political, but you can't even turn on your TV or radio right now. And I know John and I and others that study this, we can see the relevance all the time. And it goes right back to Appomattox. It goes right back to the war. I think that's why people are so enthralled with this or so interested in this and keep coming back. It's because you can't close the book on it. It's in some ways, sadly or interestingly, however you want to put it, in some ways it's not really over.
You know, most of us won't encounter a great historic event on a personal level in our lives. Occasionally, some of us might, but, you know, we can very much relate to the human experience that these people endured. That has, you know, beyond the political relevance and relevance with respect to social issues and all of that, for people to understand what happened at a given spot at a given moment in time 150 years ago and to be on that place, you know, with their mind's eye activated, that's a pretty powerful experience. And you don't have to know a lot about history to get something out of that, to get that very site-specific, immediate experience. And I think, you know, the battlefields offer that. And it's not always a happy story. It's a story that breaks your heart at times. You know, but this cumulative toil that is America, you know, it's important to understand. And you know, the efforts made by people common and people great to push this country along this kind of arc of history that we're on, you can encounter that every place. And, you know, we live in a community in Fredericksburg where a local history reverberates way beyond its boundaries. I mean, we have a local story that matters to the nation, and so does Appomattox. And, you know, people, I think the most powerful interaction that people have with history is being on these places where they happen and where it happened, and to interact with the story on a very, very human level.
John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. Ernie Price with Appomattox Courthouse National Historical Park here this morning. More on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook. Just search News Talk 1230 WFVA. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
We're talking about the sesquicentennial of the Civil War this morning and how it all ended about 3 weeks ago in Appomattox. John Hennessy, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here, along with Ernie Price, the chief of education and visitor services at Appomattox Courthouse National Historical Park. Ernie, with what you dealt with just recently, what did you find either an event or two or a situation most meaningful?
Well, I think I'm going to give two answers to that. And John alluded to it before. I think with these events, and especially at Appomattox, it's such a fascinating landscape. It's a unique landscape to walk into a village. And when we have an event like this and you have 1,000 reenactors come in for something like this, you get the opportunity to see some visuals that it's quite authentic sometimes. It almost kind of blows you away. You'll look up and just see something that, you know, we're here 360 days out of the year and year after year. It's like, man, I've never seen that. The morning of the 9th, we had heavy rain that early morning, but it produced a tremendous bank of fog on the morning of the 9th, which, of course, is historically exactly what happened 150 years ago. And so as we came into the village that morning, there's a silhouette of Federal cavalry up on the ridge west of the village. And at that moment, I think all of us, we just, our hearts just skipped a beat, and we were absolutely blown away to just be there witnessing that. Hollywood had nothing on Appomattox on the morning of April 9th, 2015. There's no way they could have done that. And I know, as magical as they are, it was unbelievable. And I would also point to a second thing that was also very unique, maybe really even more unique than that. We had a program called Footsteps to Freedom, where we reached out to the African-American community in Appomattox and surrounding counties, and in a nutshell, put together a 100-person choir and reenacted to the best of our ability what we perceived would have been the funeral of Hannah Reynolds, the only civilian casualty at Appomattox Courthouse in the fighting that morning, who happened to be an enslaved woman who was mortally wounded on the morning of the surrender and died 3 days later. And to hear her eulogy, and I think a lot more was being eulogized than just Hannah Reynolds' life, and to see the 4,600 luminaries that followed in the village representing each emancipated person in Appomattox County as a result of the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. You know, luminaries are a pretty common thing at some parks. They've done them historically. They've never been done here. And to see the funeral and the luminaries running the entire length of the village, it was an absolutely breathtaking, unforgettable scene, and I'll never forget it. I'll take it with me the rest of my life.
With what you dealt with, Ernie, that in those days, will just like something like that. Do you see that in the future, certain things may have been kind of spawned through this that you may do now on a regular basis?
Well, I certainly hope so. Now, I'm not speaking specifically about luminaries or particular programs, but I am thinking about relationships that have been forged here in and around Appomattox. You know, we don't have quite the population base that you do there in Fredericksburg and along the I-95 corridor. Appomattox is still a very rural place. It's sometimes eerily similar to maybe what it would have been like when you look at the phone book and you see all the same names that you see in a local company's roster from 1861. But important relationships, as I mentioned, the African-American community, which historically has been pretty disengaged with the park here, and not pointing blame to anybody. It's just the way it was. There's plenty of blame to go around. But what's important is that I hope that we're starting to move past that. And we had genuine buy-in by hundreds of members of the local community in this program who now are beginning to think about the park differently and are seeing that every American has a story at Appomattox. And I'm really excited about the possibilities of what this may generate in years to come. We may see some programs and some commemorations that have never happened before since the park was incepted, as we saw with the Footsteps to Freedom program. So I'm very hopeful of that. I really think that can happen.
John, with what happened here, with same question, are anything come from the 3 years and all the 26 days of programs that you did here?
Well, I think consistently the most powerful experiences are those that mean so much to the people who are there. Appomattox, the number of things that I saw at Appomattox that meant so much to the people who were there. Excuse me, we had readers, we had the participants in Hannah Reynolds' funeral who tearfully, in some cases, I don't know that they were, of course they didn't know Hannah Reynolds. Their emotion was not rooted in her death per se, but what her death symbolized. And, you know, this woman robbed of any time as a freed person, there was a genuine mourning with that. Many of the readers that we engaged in some of the programs at Appomattox, you know, for them, it was one of the high points of their life to be able to share a family story or with the audience there. For Bud Robertson, you know, he was the keynote speaker, very well-known historian, maybe Virginia's most famous Civil War historian, gave the keynote address, and I ran into him about 5 hours later. And he came up to me with tears in his eyes, thanking us for having him do that. And so it's always very powerful for me to see things that matter so much to people. You know, here in Fredericksburg, we had, you know, many of the same experiences here. And you never know where that's going to come out at you. And whenever it does, it rolls you over. You know, I think for us, one of the most powerful things in Appomattox at Fredericksburg was for the Fredericksburg Battle 150th, the presence here of the descendant units, the 69th New York of the Irish Brigade, and the Stonewall Brigade being here, and especially the Irish Brigade, and there were 60-some-odd of them present. You know, a modern unit that was down at Fort AP Hill for training at the time. But those guys, and women, in fact, to stand in the spot, in the place where their predecessor unit had fought on in front of the sunken road, and to have 2,000 members of the audience pass review in front of them, they knew exactly what that meant, and they knew exactly what it meant to the audience as well. So, you know, the 150th was, you know, we tend to think the people who aren't engaged in this business sometimes think of it rather scornfully as a bunch of, you know, kind of fun sort of thing. I would aver that Ernie or I or any of our counterparts at any of the other parks who were engaged in it are engaged in it and remember it because it was an experience of such meaning for people. And you know what? We work with this stuff every day, and it means a great deal to us. And so we get kind of the dual pleasure of kind of experiencing the history, which is interests us tremendously, but also the satisfaction of watching our visitors engage in that history. And that in and of itself can be pretty powerful for us.
Ernie, before I let you go, give a little commercial, if you will, for what you've got down there at Appomattox. For people around here, Appomattox is near Lynchburg. It's not that far away. And like you say, it's a rural area, and I saw it last summer, and it's a terrific place to visit.
Well, my advice would be to try to get over here this summer. I'm not on commission or anything, but there's a real reason for that. Because of the 150th, first of all, we have a new film that just debuted at the 150th that we show now. But we have some special exhibits on display, things that have been loaned to us for the 150th. Some really interesting pieces from General Sheridan's staff, from General George Custer. A couple of things from the McLean House that were there during the surrender, et cetera, et cetera. But the Alpha exhibit, if you will, are the actual terms of surrender. Your listeners may know, but there was not actually a single piece of paper that Lee and Grant signed for the surrender. Grant wrote a letter describing the terms to Lee, and Lee had his secretary, Charles Marshall, write a letter accepting the terms, which Lee edited and ultimately signed, and they exchanged letters. That's how the Army of Northern Virginia was written out of existence. However, the final draft of that letter that Grant wrote for Lee was actually penned by Ely Parker, one of his secretaries, signed by Grant, given to Lee, and Lee left with that letter, left Appomattox, and went back home to Richmond. That's the letter we now have on display in our visitor center, and I would like to thank the folks at Stratford Hall, who loaned us the document, and it's here all summer. So it's the first time it's been back here in 150 years. So, you know, if you've never been to Appomattox, this summer is a great time to think about coming, because you have the authenticity of place, and now you have the authenticity of what it was really all about, these two pieces of paper that make up this letter that brought the whole thing to a close, and it's really powerful.
And it's you're right, but John mentioned it's a powerful place. Just the way everything is set up, and you've got a lot of people who do a lot of living history kind of things, and it's a good place to spend the day. And again, it's just down just outside of Lynchburg, not that far from here. Ernie Price, Chief of Education and Visitor Services at Appomattox Courthouse National Historical Park, with us this morning. Ernie, thank you for your time, and we'll stay in touch.
Ted, thank you so much, and your listeners have a real treasure over there with John. He did so much to make this event what it was. So thank you, thank John, and enjoyed the time with you this morning.
John Hennessy also with us. When we come back, we're going to talk about Chancellorsville, because there are events taking place this weekend to commemorate the anniversary for that. More on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's now 8:33.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station.
Babies.
You're listening to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got an opinion about today's show? Voice it now on Facebook. Search News Talk 1230 WFVA and place your comments now. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park with us this morning. We're going to focus on some local stuff the rest of the program. John, a report came out this week that tied $49 million in economic benefits to this area from the park, just from the local parks in this area last year. That's a pretty impressive number. We've often talked about economically, and there have been these reports before, but to actually see that number this week, I was surprised by that.
Well, that includes both what we spend in the park and our budget, and also the spending of the of visitors to this place. It's the easiest money any community can ever get.
Yeah,
it's these people come from out of town. They spend their money here and leave. We don't have to send them to school. We don't have to, support them with tremendous infrastructure. But that $49 million, which of course bounces through the local economy like crazy, and economists of course have multipliers and all that stuff that figure out the real impact, supports somewhere over 600 jobs in this community. That's but when we kind of contemplate the tourism industry here, which is not even much bigger than us, I think the Park Service, provides kind of an anchor for the tourism industry in this area, but there's lots of other stuff going on in the tourism industry. The challenge and the reason that people don't recognize the economic impact of tourism here is because all those employees that are supported by the visitors who come to the park or other attractions in the area, they're not all in one place. It's not like a Geico call center one of the industrial places down in the industrial park. They're spread out in the community, and there's a third of a job here and a half a job there. But the impact is still the same. Tourism is the cleanest, easiest money that communities can possibly make. The profit margin, if you will, on tourism money is so much higher than it is, from local spending, where we do have to spend the kids to school and build subdivision roads and things of that sort of thing. None of that happens with visitors from out of town. So, I also think we forget to realize, having a national park unit, a unit of the National Park Service in your community, boy, how much is that worth? Amount of publicity that just is built into that, the being one of 407 units. Here we are on the eve of the centennial of the National Park Service. There's a tremendous amount of buzz and attention about that. This, America's greatest idea that's spread across the world in many ways. But to go out and replicate the visibility that having a national park in your midst brings, it would cost millions of dollars every year to do that. But being part of this system, this great idea, is a tremendous boon to this community. Most towns of Fredericksburg size in America, most people have never heard of. But Americans have heard of Fredericksburg.
Because of
the presence of the national park here and the tremendous events that occurred here 150 plus years ago.
It's funny you say that, because I said to somebody last night, I live in the greatest area, because yesterday I was out at Chancellorsville and saw the stone that they placed there where they think that where Stonewall Jackson was shot, the exact right near Route 3. Earlier in the week, I had tracked down and found the grave of Willie Jett, who turned John Wilkes Booth, and then on Sunday over in Port Royal to see all of that. That's just a tiny thing. And this weekend, we've talked about what our favorite artifacts at this park has, but out at Chancellorsville, the map, Jackson's flank map that he penciled out on a piece of paper with Robert E. Lee is going to be on display again, and I can go see that. There are just a lot of things here that you've got an opportunity to do and see.
Yeah, and that just kind of scratches the surface.
Yeah.
One of the things that we love to do, I'll give you, our History at Sunset series, which I know that you've been involved with, I think the magic of that for people is that we see it just kind of peels away the superficial layer and exposes some things that people just never paid attention to before. It's not detail, but it's just kind of this peeling away process of finding things in places that you've never seen before. You know, Willie Jett's grave is a perfect example. You know, here's a man who is famous for turning Booth in, but of course he also protected Booth at first, and only when he was confronted did he turn him in. So interesting story there. But you know, our landscape here around Fredericksburg is just filled of such places like that. Caroline County last weekend did their commemoration of really the end of one of the most tumultuous periods in American history when Booth was killed at the Garrett Farm on Route 301. The tumult that attended the manhunt for Booth and the uncertainty about what this was it, you know, this Confederate uprising, was it just this lone crazy man, and we still argue about that. That kind of history that happened right here reverberated across the landscape at the time.
Yeah.
And we just have so much of that here. Just, you know, I've often said it, every place in America has a history, but not many of them have a history that reverberate like that in Fredericksburg does. Not only is it interesting to visitors, but it's interesting for the people who live here, who pay attention and who just take the time to kind of unpeel this sort of thing. I mean, I drive along and I drive, you know, my kids and my wife nuts because they'll say, well, you know, behind that house was blah, 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 and behind that house was blah, blah, blah. And perhaps I do overdo it a little bit sometimes, but there is great interest and virtue in all of these little hidden secrets and places that some of which are way more important than we could ever imagine.
And I'm continually learning things. I mean, I didn't know until someone reposted the story about Willie Jett being buried over in the Confederate cemetery that was even here.
Yeah.
And I'm always finding out. The program I remember last year, a number of the programs at Wilderness and Spotsylvania Courthouse now, certain landmarks that for years I drove by and had no idea that there was a significance.
A couple of years ago, I went out to the White Oak Museum, you know, D.P. Newton's great place. Maybe in its own way, the greatest Civil War museum in America. Certainly the greatest local Civil War collection that there is. And if you haven't been there, you should go. But as I was there, we were there with some friends. A wagon pulled by a mule came up the road. And I was like, well, this is kind of interesting. What it was the anniversary. It was April 26th, the anniversary of Booth's death. And Booth, after he was killed at the Garrett Farm, was ferried across the river at Port Royal and then hauled by wagon to Belle Plaine in Stafford County and put on a steamboat, his body was, and carried to Washington. Well, they were just kind of commemorating that passage, and they had a mule wagon with the John Wilkes Booth feet sticking out the end of it. And it was just this very interesting, in its own way, very compelling expression to the past. Certainly one of the biggest things that ever happened in White Oak was the passage of John Wilkes Booth, and they remembered. So there's all sorts of little things like that. We're very fortunate. You know, most of us don't pay attention to history as we go through our days, but every once in a while, most of us decide to at some point. Here we don't have to go far to indulge ourselves on that account.
No, and when you have visitors, it's always fun to take them to a battlefield or two and just show them some things. And you think of a lot of it with Booth, some of the what-ifs. I mean, he was trying to get from the Garrett Farm. He had decided in his last few hours that he wanted to get over to Orange County and how he could have been really close to us.
Yeah, so all these great We live in an area where the great ideas, the great moments of history that are so famous and so powerful, you know, the ideas of history, freedom and liberty and all of these things, all of them took very human, tangible form here. The places associated with those stories are still with us today.
There are stories to be told this weekend. It is this is when 152 years ago that Chancellorsville was taking place. We'll talk about some of the things going on this weekend as we continue along this morning with John Hennessy on Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Welcome back to Town Talk with Ted on News Talk 1230 WFVA. You can weigh in on today's Town Talk topic on Facebook. Just search News Talk 1230 WFVA. Now, your host, Ted Schubel.
John Hennessy with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park here with us this morning. This weekend, 152 years ago is when the Battle of Chancellorsville was taking place. You don't have not nearly the number of activities you had a couple of years ago at this time, but still, you're going to remember it with at a number of key points. And what's interesting, as things go, you're able to do a lot of these events again on the day that they actually took place.
Right. Well, that we're lucky in that the calendar works for us this year. May 2nd and 3rd is a weekend.
Yeah.
That's not always the case. Yes, we're going to do a couple of the programs that we did in 150th form, in somewhat smaller form, more intimate form, with Frank O'Reilly and Beth Parnitza, you know, two of our absolute best. We'll be out doing programs on Saturday, an afternoon program on Jackson's flank attack, and then an evening program. And if you haven't ever done this, an evening program at Chancellorsville focused on Jackson's wounding. This will be a walking experience. On the 150th, we had so many people, we had to just kind of sit them.
Yeah.
But this will be a walking experience. And to do it at the time is just a powerful thing. So, you know, we'll be out there from 7:30. Program begins at 7:30. We'll be present, you know, for as long as people want to be out there that night. We have a pretty sophisticated audience, who some of whom have figured out that the time change between then and now actually means that if a 9 o'clock time in 1863, which is when Jackson was mortally wounded, actually means 11 minutes after 10 today. So because of daylight savings time and a small adjustment to Greenwich Mean Time done after the war. So, I'm sure people will be out there the entire time. Our staff will be there. To experience that with, you know, Frank O'Reilly and Beth Parnitza and Peter Moggle will be on that one as well. That's good. And then we're also doing some programs on Sunday. May 3rd was really, truly one of the three or four worst days of the war in terms of casualties, comparable to Antietam and July 2nd at Gettysburg. But we often kind of look at the Battle of Chancellorsville as if it ends when Jackson is wounded on May 2nd. So we hope that people will come out on Sunday, May 3rd. We're doing a 10 a.m. program and a 1 p.m. program that deal with the very heavy fighting in the woods around Chancellorsville on May 3rd. So these are great places. The battlefields are, they're powerful places historically. But even if you don't come out for a walk or something of that sort, we hope that, that we have 8,000 acres of open space in a suburban community. And these are pretty special open spaces as well. We hope that people will just come out and find their park, as the motto goes for the National Park Service for the next year during the centennial, and spend some time exploring the park in all its forms. These are beautiful places as well as important places.
Yep. And then a week from Sunday on the 10th, you've got a program out at in Caroline County, where at the Jackson Shrine where he died.
Well, and Frank O'Reilly is going to do that. And if you haven't had the Frank O'Reilly experience at the Jackson Shrine, it is one of the premier interpretive experiences in the National Park Service anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And
he spoke 2 years ago without notes for at least a half hour,
right,
on Jackson's last hours. And it was just, it was just spine tingling.
Right. The only challenge people need to recall with that is that there is a bridge out on the road between I-95 and the Jackson Shrine. So if they're going, they need to go down Route 2 and go go that way to get there. But that's at 3:30 on Sunday, May 10th, which is Mother's Day. 3:30 to 4:30. Let us cross over the river, and that's program on Jackson's last moments.
We mentioned before about the map being at Chancellorsville. That goes out today, and I remember seeing that the last time when it came out. And as far as artifacts go, that's a pretty impressive artifact to have.
We were queried by Google last year as to what our signature artifact was, because they were doing kind of an online exhibition. And so we had a pretty rigorous park debate about what was our most important or vivid artifact. And the Jackson map, which was probably the last map that he drew, it's in his own hand. And Lee acquired it. It was given to Lee after Jackson's death. And Lee folded it into a biography of Jackson. And there it is. We don't put it out very often because, of course, it's very sensitive to light and all. But it will be out for about the next month or so at Chancellorsville, starting today. And, you know, there are other great artifacts out there. The new exhibits, they're still new. They're only a year old. If you haven't seen the new exhibits of both Chancellorsville and Fredericksburg, they're well worth it. We're very pleased with how they came out. And they put a emphatically human face on this story.
I'm still waiting for, and I'm still hoping that someday, you, at least for a month or two, you could have the jacket that that Jackson was wearing. That's in Lexington right now, but it needs to come back here at least for a visit.
Well, I think there are two artifacts of that sort that we would like. One is the coat that Jackson was wearing the night that he was wounded, which is the centerpiece artifact at the VMI Museum in Lexington. But also the stump of the 22-inch oak tree.
That's at the Smithsonian, isn't it?
That was cut down
by
bullets in Spotsylvania in May of 1864. Picked up by the Union Army as it passed through the battlefields at the end of the war and carried back and deposited in the Smithsonian Institution, where it remains today. It's always been one of my career goals to get the stump back on the battlefield again, and we almost had arranged that years ago, but then it just did not work out.
There are Memorial Day events and a lot of things in the summer, and we will talk to you before Memorial Day to preview that.
I'm glad to be here.
Our hockey teams are out of it, so we can't talk hockey this morning.
Yours more ignominiously than mine. You lose to a Florida team, and that's bad.
I know. John Hennessy, the chief historian with the Fredericksburg and Spotsylvania National Military Park. That's it for Town Talk. See you Monday on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.